You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
For the past two decades, the Patagonian toothfish, under the name Chilean sea bass, has been a favorite of diners and chefs in some of New York's finest restaurants. But because of that popularity, the fish faces an uncertain future. And that's the subject of G. Bruce Neck's latest book, Hooked: Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. It's published by Rodale Books, and I'm very pleased to have brought Mr. Neck back to my show today. Hello.
Hi, good to be here.
Doesn't the story involving the Patagonian toothfish begin with a guy named Lee Lance? I mean, the fish has been around for a long time, but this story really begins around 1977.
That's right. The fish is an incredibly deep water fish. It lives in water up to a mile deep. And so nobody was catching them until the technology got to the point where people were fishing at that depth. And the first place they were caught was off Chile, where the continental shelf is quite narrow. It was an unwanted bycatch. They caught it. Lee Lance noticed that it was in the back of the boat, sort of in the edge of the market. Nobody knew what to do with it. They were selling it for basically anybody would take it. One person was dyeing it orange and injecting a chemical that made it taste a little smoky and trying to market it as smoked salmon. Well, that didn't work very well. And so Lee Lance saw it and noticed some things about its flesh and thought that in spite of its unpopularity there, it might have a future in America.
And it was only unpopular because it wasn't known well. But the first people who responded well to it were Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that sets this fish apart from other fish is, firstly, its incredibly high oil content. It's white-fleshed, and that's what Lee thought would make it work. It doesn't have a lot of flavor of its own, but it can take on any flavor that you give it. And a strange thing, it's almost impossible to overcook. You can leave it on a grill. You can put it in the broiler. It doesn't matter. You can forget about it, walk around the block. You can come back, and it's still okay. And that's what the Chinese restaurants liked about it, and they also liked something else. He was offering it in the early days for $1, $1.25 a pound, and they were substituting it for black cod or sable, which was much more expensive.
So is it a sea bass? Is it a cod?
It's not a cod, it's not a bass, it's not a sea bass, and it was found off the coast of Chile. It's now difficult to find there. Lee Lance had a problem. If you look it up in the FDA now, it's still called Patagonia toothfish. In Chile, they call it Bacalao de Profundidad, cod of the deep. So he did something that's not new in the fish industry. He came up with a new name. He thought it looked a little bit like a bass, that white flaky flesh. He said, well, that's kind of bass-like. But this is an old story. You know, you've had orange roughy, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what orange roughy was called before it was called orange roughy?
I'm afraid to find out.
Slime head.
So I'm calling it that from now on.
So go into the restaurant and say, I'd like a piece of your slime head. And if that gets no response, we'll say, I'll try the toothfish.
Well, actually, we hope that people are not serving the toothfish. But you mentioned that this is a fish without much flavor and that you can't overcook. I would think that wouldn't have much appeal to some of the top chefs. But this started popping up in some of the finest restaurants in America.
The culinary history began long before anybody realized. It was the Chinese restaurants, as you mentioned, in the late 70s. In the 80s, it began to get a little more popular, first in the southern part of California, and then it kind of leapfrogged in the early 90s to the white tablecloth restaurants, the ones we talk about, the ones that are reviewed, the ones that are emulated on both coasts.
But Tribeca Grill, is one of the first here.
Actually, the first restaurant I found in the East Coast, happens to be in New York, that served it was in 1990, and it was the Four Seasons restaurant. And what did they call it? Well, they came up with their own name. They called it a Corvina bass. Now, that's particularly odd because there is a type of fish that's a Corvina, and there are bass. This fish is neither. But you know what? It didn't matter. It was the most popular fish on the menu at the Four Seasons restaurant. It wasn't on all the time. They sort of rotate things in and out. But when it was on the menu, it was the top-selling fish they had.
This just tells me that you can call anything anything you want.
Well, it does sort of seem that way. It kind of makes you sort of skeptical about a lot of things seafood.
And then it became popular, and of course the price went up, and that made it even better.
Yeah, and it also caused something else. I mean, it caused this demand to really sort of unleash fleets of fishing vessels. And we're not talking about small-time fishing vessels. We're talking about industrialized vessels. The one that I write about in the book is one that uses long lines with 15,000 baited hooks, and it can catch 10, 20, even 30 tons of fish in a single day.
Now, it was found originally off of Chile. Where else are these fish located?
Well, what happened when the after the demand took off in the U.S., Chile was eager to sort of develop this resource. They invited some vessels, foreign vessels, in to gave them permits. But then the illegals came along. Chile wasn't in a position to really enforce their rights to the fishery. And it took a couple of years. The fish were gone. The pirates, the illegal fishermen, then went around the corner to Argentina. Same story. 2 years, they're gone. Then they went to South African waters off a couple of islands. And same story. It took 2 years. Fleets of industrialized fishing vessels took away the habitat before the South African government even realized that it was there.
So the fishermen chase the supply, and then it's made illegal because they overfish.
Well, illegal.
I mean, is this fish more prone to being overfished than some because of the way it is? Because we eat an awful lot of salmon, and it's not as endangered as this fish is.
It's particularly vulnerable for a couple of reasons. Number one, it has a very long lifespan, and it doesn't reproduce itself until it's 12 or 13. And in addition to that, it stays in one place. It stays in its habitat. So once you find that habitat, and, you know, I said a ship can take 10, 20, 30 tons, well, often they work with several ships together in tandem, these illegal operators. And so it doesn't take long before it really amounts to what I call in the book strip mining.
In recent years, a number of well-known chefs have announced that they are not serving Chilean sea bass anymore because it's become endangered. Do you think most restaurant goers and chefs have been made aware of the issues regarding this fish?
Well, there is a campaign, and it's led by the same chefs that embrace the fish, the ones that really like the way, you know, they liked it because, yes, it has no flavor, but you can add any spice to it. You can use any cooking method. It kind of takes on whatever you give it. As one chef put it to me, it's the perfect date. It doesn't matter what you do to it. It just comes out great. But these chefs, after they realized that the fish was in trouble, and they saw it because the fish were getting smaller, you know, the 50-pound fish that they were getting suddenly was no longer available. There were 20 pounds, 15 pounds, babies, basically. They came together, and many listeners will be aware of the Take a Pass on Chilean Sea Bass campaign, which has raised awareness. That's the good news. The bad news is the other people who serve the fish, these are caterers, hotels, cruise ships, the people who cook fish in very large quantities and like that resilience that we were talking about, the ability to cook it this afternoon, put it on a shelf, and then reheat it later that night. You can't do that with any other fish, but you can with this. So the bad news is those and Las Vegas, places like that, they're still serving it in great quantities.
And that means that there's still a lot, there's a huge supply, even if the fish is in danger of going extinct.
Well, you know, extinction happens. Extinct means you catch the very last fish. Hard to do. There's a concept called commercial extinction, which has happened. That happened in South Africa. So the fish is very much endangered by any definition of the word. Yes, there are still are some left, and there are legal operators who are still fishing for it legally, which makes it a little bit complicated.
Although you tell the story of a great sea chase with an illegal operator, and I'll get to that in just a moment. My guest is G. Bruce Knecht, K-N-E-C-H-T. His latest book, Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish, published by Rodale. Last time you were here, it was to talk about something very different, a tragic yacht race. That was the proving ground. You're still with the Wall Street Journal. Do you see this as a business story?
Well, it is a business story, and because it's about fish, but it's ultimately about money. You know, the fishing industry in this country is, has dwindled to, it's a pretty marginal proposition, and that's because the populations of most of the fish we like to eat are less than 10% of what they were 50 years ago. But here you have a fish, the Vyarsa, the vessel I write about. We could buy that vessel for $1.5 million. We could fill it with 300 tons of fish. What could we sell that for? $3.5 million. So one voyage of 2-3 months, we've covered all our capital costs, we have a huge profit, and then we go fishing again.
And they're fishing off of Australia. So they're...
Way off Australia. The chase that sort of is the centerpiece of the book happened halfway between Australia and South Africa. So it's a 12 days steam from the west coast of Australia. It's a few hundred miles north of Antarctica. So it's off the coast of Australia, but it's basically in a place where there's nothing else. You try to picture that on the map, there's really nothing there.
But the Australians are going after it, the Australians Customs Service.
The chase began near Heard Island, which is an Australian piece of land.
The reason
why it's illegal is basically because they don't have a permit. It's no different if you and I went fishing on a lake. We either get a permit or we don't get a permit.
So they didn't know whether there were toothfish on this boat or something else. They just knew that there was illegal fishing.
They were pretty sure it was illegal fishing, and they were virtually certain it was toothfish because that is the fish that's there. That is the fish that has the profits that drive the fleets to basically the bottom of the earth.
So what happens when a governmental ship starts chasing after a fishing vessel and winds up in the middle of the ocean? Are they still able to board and arrest people if necessary?
There's a concept established by the UN Law of the Sea called hot pursuit, which basically says if you have reason to believe that a vessel has done something illegal in your waters, you have the right to pursue them, and yet that right does not expire when they leave your waters. It does expire when they reach their own territory, which was kind of what this 4,000-mile chase that went on for 3 weeks.
4,000 miles. That has to be one of the longest sea chases in history.
Well, if I was a little bolder, I would have said in the book that it was the longest chase in nautical history. But I was just afraid that somebody somebody listening today would say that the British Navy in 1893 had a chase that went 5,300 miles. I couldn't find one that was longer. They went halfway around the world. They went halfway around Antarctica.
They went to Antarctica because they thought that they would shake off the Australians?
Yeah, the illegal fishing vessel fled immediately south, which is to say towards Antarctica. And what they did, basically, they got to the ice, they took a right, and they kept going. And that means they went through an obstacle course of icebergs, the sea itself was freezing. At one point, they set the radar of the patrol boat that was doing the pursuing on 24 miles, and they detected 72 icebergs within 24 miles. And the chase was going at high speed, night and day, through this icy water.
Captain Cabrera is responsible for defying the law here. Where is he from?
He's Uruguayan. The vessel was registered in Uruguay. But the kingpin, the owner of the boat, and the fishing master, they're from Spain. They're that northwest part of Spain, Galicia, where I know one of your guests, Mr. Mark Kurlansky, has written about the cod fishermen from there. That's where they came from. They had been fishing for cod basically since the 1400s. It's the same families. And as cod disappeared, the people on the Vyarsa looked for something new, and they came up with toothfish.
When they finally were caught, with the cooperation of South Africa, what happened? Have they been brought to trial?
They have been brought to trial. I don't want to sort of completely give away the end of the story, but I can tell you that it's very difficult to have evidence that will stand up in court of illegal fishing. The problem is you need to either have a photograph of them fishing, you need to get gear in the water that you're going to somehow be able to connect to the boat. Very difficult to do. The fishing master, the Vyarsa, this is a little clue to what happened. I had an email from him a couple of weeks ago. He told me he is going fishing again. And it's for toothfish. And by the way, a big part of the book is about him. He doesn't think he's done anything wrong. He thinks he's supporting his family, doing what he knows how to do, the only thing people in his family have ever done.
And a lot of other people don't seem to think it's wrong or pay much attention. You write about Daniel Pauly, an academic, who often talks about the negative effects of overfishing in his own work, and he says he gets little support even from other academics.
That's very true. What the fishermen say, what Antonio Perez says, is don't worry about this fish. There'll always be another one. And for most of our history, there always has been another one. But one of the points I make in the book, and this is very much with the support of Daniel Pauly, who's probably the world's most prominent fisheries scientist, is that this may be the end of the road. This may be the last big fin fish we will ever find that exists in large quantities that hasn't been exploited.
Now, we have pretty much made the consumption of Caspian Sea caviar illegal. Can we do that with other fish until they recover?
Difficult to do. There's a political constituency for fishermen. There are legal fishermen for toothfish and other fish.
We're seeing that with whales, where whaling continues despite the fact that pretty much all the world is against it.
Yeah, all the world except for the people who really like consuming it. You know, those Japanese who, apparently it's a very small percentage of the population who like to eat it, but the Japanese whaling vessels are out all the time conducting their so-called experiments.
Well, maybe we'll have to do some experiments to keep fishing the toothfish as well. G. Bruce Necht, his book Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish, published by Rodale. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.